A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal. He put Ezra to bed around 9:30, was so exhausted he just stayed there, and ended up sleeping 12 or 13 hours straight till 10 the next morning. Felt fantastic afterwards. But it got him thinking, even when we're massively sleep-deprived, there seems to be a hard ceiling on how long humans can sleep. He might manage 13, 14 hours once in a blue moon, but nobody's sleeping 24 hours to wipe out a week's sleep debt in one go. He wants to know what the physiological reason is for that cap. And honestly, I've wondered this myself.
Oh, this is a great question. It gets at something most people feel intuitively, but never quite articulate. That sense that your body just won't let you keep sleeping past a certain point, no matter how exhausted you were going in. There's a real biological ceiling here, and it's not just habit or social convention.
Before we dig in, quick note, today's script is being written by DeepSeek V4 Pro. So if anything comes out especially coherent, that's why.
Though I like to think we'd be coherent regardless. Anyway, Daniel's experience is a perfect case study. He slept roughly 12 and a half hours, felt refreshed, and that's almost exactly at the upper boundary of what's physiologically possible for a healthy adult under normal conditions. The hard cap isn't arbitrary.
What sets it? Because you just wake up isn't an explanation.
There are two main systems that regulate sleep, and they interact in a way that naturally puts a ceiling on duration. The first is the circadian system, your internal 24-hour clock centered in the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the hypothalamus. The second is the homeostatic sleep drive, sometimes called process S, which builds up pressure to sleep the longer you're awake. These two systems are in a constant push-pull, and that push-pull is what creates the ceiling.
Walk me through the push-pull. I know the basics, but how does it actually enforce a maximum?
Process S is basically a chemical accumulation. Adenosine builds up in the brain during waking hours as a byproduct of energy metabolism in neurons. The longer you're awake, the more adenosine binds to receptors, particularly in the basal forebrain, and the sleepier you feel. When you sleep, adenosine gets cleared out at a fairly consistent rate, and that's one of the first constraints on sleep duration. Once adenosine is sufficiently cleared, that pressure to sleep drops off significantly.
The chemical that builds the debt also determines when the debt is paid off. You can't overpay.
Caffeine works by blocking adenosine receptors, which is why it masks sleepiness without actually reducing the debt. But here's the key. Even in massive sleep debt, the rate at which adenosine clears during sleep doesn't speed up dramatically. It's not like a faster drain just because the tub is fuller. The enzymatic breakdown proceeds at a relatively steady pace, so you can't clear a week's worth of buildup in one night. The biochemistry simply doesn't scale that way.
That's one constraint. What's the other half?
The circadian system. Your internal clock has a strong wake-promoting signal that ramps up in the morning, driven partly by light exposure and partly by the clock's intrinsic rhythm. Even if you went to bed at 9:30 p.m. like Daniel, by 7 or 8 a.m. your circadian system is sending an alerting signal that says time to be awake. That signal grows stronger through the morning and competes directly with any remaining sleep drive.
You've got falling sleep pressure and rising wake pressure, and they cross each other. That intersection is your wake-up point.
That's the two-process model in a nutshell, originally formalized by Alexander Borbély in the early 1980s. It's still the dominant framework. Process S declines during sleep. Process C, the circadian wake drive, rises according to its own schedule, and where they meet, you wake up. The reason you can't sleep 24 hours straight is that process S would be essentially depleted long before then, while process C would be at full strength, and there's nothing left to keep you asleep.
Daniel felt terrible during the week, and fantastic after one long sleep. Doesn't that suggest he did catch up on something?
He caught up on something, but not everything. This is where the distinction between acute and chronic sleep debt matters. Acute sleep debt, say you got 4 hours last night, can be substantially recovered with one or two long sleeps. The adenosine clears, cognitive performance rebounds, subjective alertness improves. But chronic sleep debt accumulated over weeks or months involves changes that go beyond adenosine. Chronic sleep restriction leads to changes in synaptic plasticity, alterations in stress hormone regulation, and even damage to specific neuronal populations. A study from the University of Pennsylvania led by David Dinges showed that people restricted to 6 hours of sleep per night for 2 weeks had cognitive deficits equivalent to staying awake for 24 hours straight, and they were subjectively unaware of how impaired they'd become.
That's the scary part. You stop noticing.
Critically, one long recovery sleep didn't fully restore their performance. It helped, but the deficits persisted. So Daniel's 12-hour sleep probably cleared his acute debt and restored his subjective sense of refreshment. But if he'd been running a deficit all week, some residual effects likely remained even if he felt great. The subjective feeling of refreshment doesn't perfectly track actual recovery.
Which brings us back to the hard cap. If chronic debt can be cleared in one go, is it just the adenosine clearance rate that sets the ceiling? Or is there something more structural?
There's something more structural. Sleep isn't uniform. It cycles through stages, roughly 90-minute cycles in adults, moving from light sleep to deep slow-wave sleep to REM sleep and back. The composition changes across the night. In the first half, you get disproportionately more slow-wave sleep, the deep restorative stage where growth hormone is released and cellular repair peaks. In the second half, REM sleep dominates, and REM has its own homeostatic pressure.
Even within a single sleep episode, the brain is prioritizing different types of recovery at different times.
Here's where the cap becomes structural. Once you've satisfied the need for slow-wave sleep, typically within the first 4 to 6 hours, the brain shifts resources toward REM. REM pressure does accumulate with sleep deprivation, but the brain can only spend so much time in REM before the need is met. After roughly 10 to 12 hours, even a severely sleep-deprived person will have cycled through enough slow-wave and REM sleep that the brain's immediate recovery requirements are largely satisfied. The brain isn't just ticking a box that says sleep completed, it's performing specific maintenance tasks. Synaptic downscaling during slow-wave sleep, memory consolidation, clearance of metabolic waste via the glymphatic system, and these processes have finite cycles. You can't double-clear the same waste product.
The glymphatic system. That's the one Macon Nettergaard's lab characterized.
Yes, University of Rochester, 2012. They showed that during sleep, cerebrospinal fluid flows through the brain in a way that literally washes out metabolic waste products. The interstitial space between brain cells expands by about 60% during sleep, allowing this flow. It's one of the most compelling explanations for why sleep is necessary rather than merely restorative in some vague sense.
That clearance presumably has a finite endpoint. Once the pipes are clean, more water doesn't make them cleaner.
The glymphatic clearance is most active during slow-wave sleep, which is front-loaded in the night. By the time you've had 8 to 10 hours of sleep, the bulk of that clearance work is done. You can't accumulate enough additional waste in the remaining hours to justify another full clearance cycle.
What about the flip side? Is there any evidence that sleeping too long can actually be detrimental? Because Daniel said he felt great, but I've definitely had mornings where I slept 10 hours and felt groggier than if I'd slept 7.
That's sleep inertia, a different phenomenon. But on harm, yes, there's epidemiological data showing a U-shaped curve for sleep duration and mortality. People regularly sleeping less than 6 hours have elevated risk, but so do people regularly sleeping more than 9 or 10. The sweet spot is 7 to 8 hours. Though that's correlation, not causation, people sleeping 12 hours regularly might have underlying conditions driving both the long sleep and the mortality risk. But there are mechanistic reasons to think excessive sleep could be a problem. Spending too long in a supine position affects venous return and can increase thrombosis risk. Extended sleep disrupts meal timing and metabolic rhythms. And some evidence links fragmented or extended sleep with increased inflammation markers, though causality is unclear.
The body has multiple reasons to put a ceiling on sleep duration. Adenosine clearance, circadian wake drive, finite glymphatic capacity, completion of slow-wave and REM cycles, and possibly protective mechanisms against prolonged immobility.
That's the picture. And this ceiling is a feature, not a bug. If humans could sleep for 24 hours straight, we'd be extremely vulnerable. The circadian system forcing you awake after reasonable recovery means you're not missing feeding opportunities, not vulnerable to predators longer than necessary, and maintaining social contact.
There's an evolutionary argument lurking there, but I'm always skeptical of just so stories.
The evolutionary pressures on sleep are genuinely complex, but the physiological mechanisms we've described are real and well-established regardless of their evolutionary origins. The cap exists because the systems that regulate sleep have built-in limits that operate on timescales preventing marathon sleep sessions.
Let's talk about the sleep debt concept itself, because Daniel flagged whether it's even a real thing. Is sleep debt a useful metaphor or a genuine physiological phenomenon?
It's both, but it's not like a bank account. You don't accrue a precise number of hours that you can pay back one-to-one. First, sleep debt doesn't accumulate linearly. If you lose 2 hours per night for 5 nights, you haven't accumulated exactly a 10-hour debt. The brain adapts. Sleep becomes more efficient, with a higher proportion of time in slow-wave sleep when you're sleep-deprived, a phenomenon called sleep intensity compensation.
The quality of sleep changes to partially offset the quantity deficit.
After sleep deprivation, your slow-wave sleep is more intense, higher amplitude slow waves on EEG. This is one of the most robust findings in sleep science. An hour of recovery sleep after deprivation is denser, more restorative than an hour of baseline sleep. That's part of why the repayment schedule isn't one-to-one. This intensity compensation is mediated partly by adenosine. Higher adenosine levels during wakefulness lead to stronger slow-wave activity during subsequent sleep. It's a direct biochemical link between the debt and the repayment.
The system tracks something closer to depth of need, rather than just duration of deprivation.
That depth of need has natural limits. Even with maximal adenosine accumulation, there's a ceiling on how intense slow-wave sleep can be, a physiological maximum to neuronal synchrony. Once you hit that maximum, additional sleep deprivation doesn't produce additional sleep intensity, it just produces dysfunction. Daniel probably hit both ceilings. He cleared his adenosine, satisfied his slow-wave sleep need, got sufficient REM, and his circadian system eventually overrode the remaining sleep drive. That's why he woke up naturally at 10 a.m. rather than sleeping through to noon. His body had done what it could do in one session.
What about the role of light? Daniel went to bed at 9:30. Presumably it was dark, but by 10 a.m., some light would be pouring in. Is light part of the hard cap mechanism or just a helpful signal?
Light is absolutely part of the mechanism. The intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells express melanopsin, detect ambient light levels, and project directly to the suprachiasmatic nucleus. When light hits these cells in the morning, it suppresses melatonin and ramps up the circadian alerting signal. This is a hardwired pathway that doesn't care how sleep-deprived you are. If your circadian clock says it's morning and light confirms it, your brain is getting a wake-up signal that's very difficult to override.
Could you theoretically extend sleep duration by blocking that light signal? Blackout curtains? Eye masks?
To a point. People do sleep longer in darkened environments. But even in complete darkness, the circadian clock has an intrinsic period, in humans, averaging about 24.2 hours, and generates its own rhythmic output independent of light. You can shift the phase with prolonged darkness, but you can't abolish the rhythm entirely. The clock will still push you toward wakefulness at some point. Michael Cipher's cave studies in the 60s and 70s are the classic example. He spent months underground without time cues. His sleep-wake cycle extended to a roughly 25-hour rhythm, but he wasn't sleeping 24 hours at a stretch. He slept about 8 to 10 hours and was awake for 15 to 17. The ratio stayed roughly similar even though the cycle lengthened.
That's fascinating. The sleep-wake ratio is conserved even when the clock drifts.
It suggests the homeostatic need for sleep and the circadian drive for wakefulness are calibrated to produce a consistent proportion, and that proportion has limits on both ends. You can't compress sleep below a certain minimum without impairment, and you can't extend it above a certain maximum because the systems that maintain sleep simply run out of steam.
Let me push on something. You said the glymphatic system clears waste, and once it's done, more sleep doesn't help. But neurons are still metabolically active during sleep. They're firing, consolidating memories, doing work. So wouldn't there be a continuous need for clearance, even during extended sleep?
Cerebral glucose metabolism drops by about 25 to 40% during slow-wave sleep compared to wakefulness, so waste production is lower. The glymphatic system's clearance rate exceeds the production rate during sleep, which is why it's a net clearance period. But you're right that waste continues to be produced. It's not zero. The point is that the accumulated waste from wakefulness is the bulk of what needs clearing. Once that's done, ongoing production during sleep is being cleared in real time at a rate that matches production. You reach a steady state, not a continuous deficit reduction. The sleep homeostat is a regulatory system seeking a set point, not zero adenosine, but a normal range. Once you're in that range, the pressure to remain asleep dissipates.
What about the role of orexin? I remember that being important for wakefulness.
Orexin, also called hypocretin, is a neuropeptide produced in the lateral hypothalamus that stabilizes wakefulness. Narcolepsy type 1 is caused by a loss of orexin-producing neurons, which is why narcoleptics can't maintain stable wakefulness. Orexin neurons are active during wakefulness and silent during sleep. As sleep progresses and homeostatic need diminishes, orexin neurons become more excitable and help tip the balance toward wakefulness. They integrate signals from both the circadian clock and the homeostatic system. When adenosine levels drop and the circadian clock signals morning, orexin neurons fire up and help consolidate the transition to wakefulness.
Daniel mentioned sleep debt and whether it's true or not. We've established it's real but non-linear. Is there a point where sleep debt becomes so severe that the normal rules break down? Could someone in extreme sleep deprivation sleep longer than the normal cap?
Randy Gardner's famous 11-day wakefulness stunt in 1964, he stayed awake for 264 hours, and his first recovery sleep was about 14 hours and 40 minutes. That's longer than the typical cap, but it's not 24 hours. Even after nearly 11 days without sleep, he couldn't break 15 hours. And after that initial long sleep, his sleep duration returned to normal within a few nights. The bulk of the recovery happened in that first extended sleep, and the rest was handled by increased sleep intensity. Gardner was 16 at the time, an adolescent with higher sleep needs and presumably greater homeostatic flexibility. If anyone could break the cap, it would be someone in that demographic under those conditions. The fact that he topped out under 15 hours tells us something real about the ceiling.
Let's talk about what refreshed actually means. Daniel said he felt very refreshed after his 12-hour sleep. What's happening physiologically when you feel refreshed versus when you don't?
Subjective refreshment is poorly understood, but it correlates most strongly with the amount of slow-wave sleep obtained and the efficiency of glymphatic clearance. There's also a neurochemical component. Dopamine signaling in the striatum and prefrontal cortex influences motivation and the subjective sense of energy. Sleep deprivation reduces dopamine D2 receptor availability in the striatum, and recovery sleep restores it. So, feeling refreshed might literally be your dopamine receptors coming back online. Adenosine clearance also correlates with the subjective sense of sleepiness dissipating. Caffeine makes you feel less sleepy by blocking adenosine receptors, and natural adenosine clearance during sleep does the same thing without the pharmacological assist.
I want to circle back to something Daniel alluded to. The idea that these marathon sleeps are rare events, maybe once or twice in a lifetime. Why is it so uncommon to even approach the cap?
Because under normal circumstances, most people don't accumulate enough sleep debt to need a 12-hour recovery sleep, and the circadian system is quite effective at waking you before you get there. Modern life also mitigates against it. Alarms, schedules, light exposure, social obligations. But even without those constraints, the homeostatic system is calibrated to produce roughly 7 to 9 hours for most adults. To need 12 hours, you have to be significantly sleep-deprived. Daniel was. He'd been running a deficit all week, dealing with a toddler who doesn't sleep consistently, and he crashed early because his body finally overrode his intention to get up. The homeostatic pressure accumulated to the point where it forced an early sleep onset, and then the combination of high sleep intensity and extended duration allowed for substantial recovery.
What about the toddler factor? Is there anything physiologically distinct about how parents experience sleep debt?
Fragmented sleep is in some ways worse than shortened sleep. 6 hours of continuous sleep versus 6 hours total broken into four segments, the fragmented sleep produces worse cognitive outcomes and greater daytime sleepiness. Sleep continuity is important for completing full cycles. If you're woken during slow-wave sleep repeatedly, you lose the most restorative portions disproportionately. A parent who gets 6 hours of fragmented sleep might have the functional equivalent of 4 hours of continuous sleep in terms of cognitive impairment. That's why Daniel's 12-hour continuous sleep felt so restorative. He wasn't just catching up on hours, he was finally getting uninterrupted cycles.
Which also explains why the cap is so firm. If fragmentation degrades sleep quality, you'd need even longer to recover. But the cap doesn't stretch proportionally. You just can't fully compensate for chronic fragmentation with one long sleep.
The damage from fragmentation accumulates in ways that aren't fully reversible by a single extended sleep. Chronic sleep fragmentation leads to changes in synaptic function and even neuronal loss in the locus coeruleus, a brainstem nucleus involved in arousal and attention. These are structural changes, not just chemical ones. Sleep isn't a universal solvent for all forms of fatigue and cognitive impairment. It's a specific set of processes that address specific needs. If those needs are met, additional sleep provides diminishing returns. If the damage is in a category that sleep doesn't directly repair, sleep won't fix it no matter how much you get.
Let's zoom out to the practical implications. If someone is running a sleep deficit, what's the optimal recovery strategy given these physiological constraints?
A single extended sleep, like Daniel's 12-hour session, is effective for acute recovery, but it shouldn't be the only strategy. For chronic deficits, the better approach is to consistently get adequate sleep over multiple nights. The body is better at recovering through a series of 7 to 9 hour nights than through one marathon session. Large swings in sleep duration between weekdays and weekends, sometimes called social jet lag, coined by Till Roenberg at Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich, can be metabolically disruptive. Large discrepancies between weekday and weekend sleep timing are associated with higher rates of obesity, metabolic syndrome, and even lower academic performance. The circadian system prefers consistency.
Daniel's 9:30 bedtime was probably closer to his natural rhythm than his usual later bedtime, at least on that particular night.
Sleep pressure can override chronotype. Even a committed night owl will fall asleep early if sufficiently sleep-deprived. But the fact that he slept through to 10 a.m. suggests his circadian system wasn't fighting the extended sleep too hard. His body was that depleted.
What's the role of napping in all this? If you can't clear all your sleep debt in one night, can naps help bridge the gap?
Naps are effective for reducing acute sleepiness and improving cognitive performance, but they don't substitute for the full sleep cycle architecture. A 20-minute nap primarily provides stage 2 sleep, which helps with alertness and motor learning, but doesn't provide the slow wave or REM sleep needed for full recovery. Longer naps of 90 minutes or more can include a full cycle, but they come with sleep inertia. And a long nap reduces sleep pressure, which can make it harder to fall asleep at night, perpetuating the deficit. Napping is a supplement, not a replacement, and needs to be used strategically.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, the idea that the cap is a feature, not a bug. From a systems design perspective, the body has multiple redundant mechanisms ensuring you don't sleep too long. That's not accidental.
It's overdetermined, which in biology usually means it's important. You've got adenosine clearance, circadian wake drive, orexin stabilization, glymphatic equilibrium, sleep cycle completion, light detection, and probably other mechanisms we haven't discovered yet, all pushing toward wakefulness after a certain point. If any one of these fails, the others still enforce the cap. That's a robust system. From an evolutionary perspective, an animal that sleeps too long misses foraging opportunities, is vulnerable to predation, and loses mating opportunities. The costs of insufficient sleep are long-term, metabolic damage, cognitive decline, but the costs of excessive sleep can be immediate.
That raises a serious point. The mechanisms enforcing the cap are likely conserved across mammals. It's not just a human thing.
Most mammals show a characteristic sleep duration that varies by species, from about 4 hours in elephants to about 20 hours in brown bats. But within each species, there's a consistent range and a hard upper limit. Even the bats, which sleep an enormous amount, don't sleep continuously for 20 hours. Their sleep is fragmented into multiple bouts. The adenosine system, the circadian clock, the glymphatic system, these are present in some form across vertebrates. The specific sleep durations vary, but the regulatory logic is conserved.
Let's address one more thing Daniel mentioned, the idea that he didn't wish to get up after putting Ezra to sleep, so he just stayed in bed. There's a behavioral component to the cap too, isn't there? Even if you could sleep longer, at some point the desire to get up, to eat, to use the bathroom, to do something, overrides the desire to stay in bed.
After 12 hours, most people are hungry, thirsty, need to urinate, and have a general urge to move. These motivational states are regulated by hypothalamic circuits that interact with the sleep-wake systems. Orexin, again, is involved. It promotes both wakefulness and food-seeking behavior. The CAP is a convergence of multiple homeostatic drives all pointing in the same direction. Sleep pressure drops, hunger rises, circadian alerting rises, bladder pressure rises. It's a coordinated push toward waking. The body has multiple needs that require wakefulness to satisfy, and the transition between states is regulated by the relative urgency of those needs.
What about the outliers? Are there documented cases of people sleeping significantly longer than 14 or 15 hours without an underlying medical condition?
Without a medical condition, it's extremely rare. There are case reports of people sleeping 16 to 18 hours, but these typically involve either extreme physical exertion, like ultra-endurance events, or recovery from severe illness. In those cases, the metabolic demands are different. Tissue repair, immune function, and the sleep architecture may be altered. But even then, 24-hour sleeps are essentially unheard of in healthy individuals. When you do see extremely long sleeps, 18-plus hours, it's usually a symptom of something pathological, depression, infection, neurological conditions. Hypersomnia is a clinical symptom, not a normal variation. Conditions like idiopathic hypersomnia, Klein-Levin syndrome, and certain mood disorders can produce extremely long sleep durations, but these involve dysfunction in the very regulatory systems we've been discussing. They're exceptions that prove the rule. The CAP exists because the regulatory systems work, and when they don't, the CAP can break.
Daniel specifically said, excluding medical conditions. So for a healthy person, the CAP is real and physiologically enforced.
His 12-hour sleep is right at the upper end of what a healthy adult can achieve under normal conditions. He essentially hit the ceiling. The fact that he felt refreshed afterward is evidence that the ceiling is well calibrated. It's set at a level that allows substantial recovery without being so high that it interferes with other biological needs.
One last question. Is the CAP fixed across the lifespan? Do infants and elderly people have different ceilings?
Newborns sleep 14 to 17 hours per day, but even they don't sleep continuously. They wake for feeding every few hours. The circadian system isn't fully developed at birth, so the CAP is less rigid, but it's still there in the form of hunger and other homeostatic drives. In the elderly, sleep becomes more fragmented and total sleep duration often decreases, but the CAP on a single sleep episode also decreases. It's rare for an elderly person to sleep 10 hours continuously even if they're tired. The CAP shifts with age but never goes away. Daniel, as a healthy adult with a toddler, is operating within the normal adult range. His 12-hour sleep was exceptional, but not pathological. It was his body doing exactly what it's designed to do, recover as much as possible within the limits of the system.
Which brings us to a satisfying conclusion. The hard cap on sleep duration isn't one mechanism, but a convergence of several. Adenosine clearance, circadian wake drive, lymphatic equilibrium, sleep cycle completion, orexin stabilization, and competing homeostatic drives. Together, they create a ceiling that even extreme sleep deprivation can't break.
That ceiling is typically around 12 to 15 hours for a healthy adult, with most people clustering at the lower end. Daniel's experience was a perfect natural experiment. He was sleep-deprived enough to hit the cap, and his body enforced it right on schedule.
The body knows what it needs, and it also knows when it's had enough.
It's one of those rare cases where the system's limits are actually well designed. You get enough sleep to recover, but not so much that you compromise other survival needs. It's elegant.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Oh, this should be good.
Subglacial lakes beneath New Zealand's South Island glaciers contain unique pigment-producing bacteria that create vivid turquoise streaks in the ice. These pigments, primarily carotenoids and phycobiproteins, were first documented by geologists in 1928 during the Canterbury Glacier Survey. The bacteria produce these compounds as sunscreen against intense ultraviolet radiation penetrating the glacial ice, and the resulting coloration was initially mistaken for copper mineral deposits by early explorers.
That's a new one.
Glacial bacteria with a skincare routine.
This has been My Weird Props, produced by Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We'll be back next time.
Until then, try not to sleep 12 hours unless you really need it.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.